Well, last week at this time we suggested getting rid of the traditional seasons. And this time, one step further, why not get rid of the human race? More room for dingoes and possums. Except in New Zealand, of course. In fact, Bruce Edgerton doesn't go that far. After all, he's a public servant in the ACT. But he's convinced a smaller global population would be good. He also has some handy suggestions about pig farming, if you're interested. Bruce Edgerton is an environmental and energy policy person with the ACT government.
My father fears for the future of our planet, infested as it must be, with 10 billion people by the end of this century. We'll need a war to wipe them out, or famine, or both. Many of the conservationists of his generation and mine agree. This Malthusian outlook is quite common. The observations of the Right Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus are as relevant today as when he published them in 1798. Population has grown exponentially, and by and large, crop production has grown linearly, with a few step changes along the way. It's now very clear to us all that the Earth's carrying capacity is limited, and we are pushing its boundaries. I feel this was most eloquently expressed by Dr. Seuss in his 1971 classic, The Lorax. So we're going to run out of food, right? The 10 billion person problem is used to justify all manner of policy propositions, such as the need to release GM foods without due diligence, or the need to raise the rainforests of the Amazon, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Myanmar for crops. The genocidal solution that accompanies my father's population fears harks back to the apocalyptic visions of Revelations, written around 95 AD. So there's nothing new here. Well, hear the good news. These visions need not eventuate. It is well within the capacity of humanity to feed the world with a little pragmatism, vision, and compassion. Tragically, while we have the technology and wealth, the vision and compassion is sorely lacking. As a matter of urgency, we need to ensure that the global population plateaus. In 2011, the UN's population division suggested the global population could peak at 7 to 8 billion people by the middle of the century. Unfortunately, this is their most optimistic scenario. The mid-range scenario plateaus by the end of the century at around 10 billion. And the worst-case scenario has the global population surging past 15 billion people in 2100, with no discernible fall in the growth rate. These are vastly different outcomes for the world that my grandchildren will inherit. Wealth eventually stops procreation in its tracks, as shown in countries as diverse as Italy and Japan. But we don't have that much time, so we need to address the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, for all girls, right now. We then need to follow this up with free contraception. Wealth will follow within a generation or so, and the global population should be contained at 10 billion or less. Of course, wealthy people eat more, and they consume food with a high environmental footprint, such as meat, dairy, and snacks. So we will face an enormous challenge to feed this world. The poor are starving because they can't afford to pay, not because we don't have the capacity to feed them. Nevertheless, we're going to have to employ a great deal more capacity to feed 10 billion people, with a middle class of maybe 6 billion. So, how do we do this? Australia's grain belt yields between 2 tonnes per hectare per year of wheat in the west, to 6 tonnes a hectare in the best parts of New South Wales and Victoria. These yields are likely to fall with climate change. The US averages around 10 tonnes per hectare a year of corn across the Midwest, and this is likely to improve with climate change, at least up to 2050, and probably out to 2100. At present, there is plenty of grain. The EU still pays farmers not to grow crops, while the US diverts its massive crop surpluses into biofuel production. However, by 2100, demand will comfortably outstrip supply. Thankfully, we are ready to deploy the next big step in agricultural production, microalgae. Microalgae production is now commercial on a very large scale at coastal sites in South Australia and Western Australia. It is used to produce beta-carotene and other high-value food supplements. A multi-billion dollar global research effort is currently underway to produce biofuels from microalgae. Some are trying to maximise the production of carbohydrates to make ethanol. Others are trying to maximise the production of lipids for biodiesel. While the yields are fantastic, none have come within a bull's roar of the price of petrol. Worse still, when you try to grow a very select strain of algae with lots of fats or carbs, a nasty, slow-growing type tends to come along and eat it. As Darwin noted, It's survival of the fittest, not the fattest, that can be expected in our evolutionary ecosystems. Nevertheless, the International Energy Authority suggested in 2009 that 250 tonnes per hectare per year of biomass was a reasonable assumption of the yields that we could expect from a commercial microalgae farm. And the industry has advanced substantially since then. Now, while it's very difficult and expensive to turn this biomass into fuel, it's relatively easy to turn it into food. The good Lord in her grace, or evolution and its destructive creativity, has gifted us with a number of creatures that love scum and muck, and who will feast off the detritus of society. Carps, pigs and chicken are amongst the creatures humanity has chosen to utilise extensively for the last few millennia. I spent a little over 10 years working in the pig industry, if you include the 3 years of postgrad studies funded by the Pig Research and Development Corporation. While I focused on environmental issues, I spent plenty of time around very smart nutritionalists. While dropping out of my PhD, I took a one-year placement with Australia's largest pig producer, nominally to write up a master's. I was surprised to find they had 4 PhDs on staff and conducted over $2 million worth of research each year. Let me assure you, pig nutritionalists can formulate a diet around whatever source of carbohydrates and fats are cheapest, generally with a dash of industrially produced amino acids, vitamins, and minerals. I know a lot less about poultry production, and even less about aquaculture. But I understand that silver carp tastes divine, and the feed conversion rates for these creatures is less than 2-1, with minimal greenhouse gas emissions. A wise Jew from Palestine once observed that man cannot live on bread alone. Furthermore, too much protein gives you colon cancer, and sadly, the delectable Atkins diet will probably give you a coronary. So a balanced diet is important. Thankfully, since the 90s, enormous progress has been made in understanding how to sustainably integrate the waste from intensive animal production into agriculture. I played a small role in this learning journey. The key environmental challenge with intensive animal production is the quantity of nutrients that require careful management. However, this should not be counted as a negative when the problem we face is feeding 10 billion people. The manures and effluents produced from intensive animal production and aquaculture are ideal for anaerobic digestion. This process converts much of the organic matter to methane and liberates the nutrients into the liquid phase. The methane can be burnt to generate heat and power. The nutrients can be shandied for fertigation into intensive horticulture. If the horticulture is undertaken in glasshouses, then the waste heat and CO2-rich exhaust gases from burning the methane can be used in the glasshouses to further increase yields. So there you have it. Grow microalgae in the dry, arid regions of the world where there is either seawater or non-potable water available for aquaculture ponds. Solar dry the biomass for transport to the peri-urban fringe. Formulate the microalgae with agricultural byproducts, vitamins and amino acids as required. Grow pigs, chicken and fish. Anaerobically digest the manures on site and fertigate the effluent into glasshouses. Hey presto, 10 billion people fed generously with a system that is highly adaptable to future changes in the climate. It's a pity then that the real problem is global poverty, and if we can't fix that, we'll be pounding past 15 billion people with tens, maybe hundreds of millions of people in the Pacific and Bangladesh soon to become climate refugees. So, what to do about it? Occam's razor is all about the least hypothesis, not the largest. And I'm running out of time. But let me have a crack at it in the few minutes left. Start by eating less beef and dairy. Drink less grog and bubble water and cappuccinos. Eat out less. All these things have an enormous environmental footprint compared to the simpler substitutes. But, despite what the modern green groups and medieval Catholics might say, wearing a hair shirt won't save your soul or fix global poverty. So, if you are to sacrifice these luxuries, you also need to take the money saved and give it to a charity that addresses the real issues. These issues involve empowering women in developing countries and addressing climate change. Even if you do all this, Jesus, aka Joshua from Palestine, noted that even if you sell your most precious possessions and give the money to the poor, you will always have the poor with you. Because the solutions to poverty require social actions at a national and international level, not just a few concerned citizens cancelling the cappuccino order. So, with 1 minute left, I throw up a few social solutions for you to debate over your next beer. We need to raise more revenues at a national level in Australia, the US, Europe and Japan. That notorious lefty, David Cameron, suggested a tax on wealth transfers, primarily designed to discourage financial speculation and to stabilise global capital markets. However, it would also raise trillions, even at 0.1% or less. We need to start taxing the things we don't want people to do, such as financial speculation and creating pollution, instead of the things we should encourage, like earning income and generating wealth. A carbon tax is an ideal platform for this. Indeed, a cap-and-trade emission trading scheme is recognised by economists of the left and right as the most effective approach to bringing global emissions under control. Though sadly, we've already missed the window to avoid 2 degrees global warming, so it's going to be a stormy ride. The aforementioned WET, Prime Minister David Cameron, notes that an emission trading scheme by itself is not enough. We will need a suite of policy tools, including regulations and targeted programs. Phasing out the use of thermal coal is one regulatory bullet we need to bite sooner rather than later. The providential arrival of unconventional gas makes this task relatively low cost. Gas will help us bridge the move into renewables, with gas-fired peaking plants backing up our wind and solar energy sources. The biggest issue remains educating the world's women and girls so they can read, write, and do a basic household budget. The developed world has a role to play in delivering this. Other than education, our aid needs to go as microcredit to small community organisations, with a priority given to those led by women, rather than as military aid to dictators, as per the majority of the US aid budget to Egypt. So there you go, a policy platform to address global poverty, hunger and climate change. I'll save world peace for my run at the Miss World title. But seriously, hear the good news. All is not lost. We can feed the poor and make this world fairer. We need not lose our humanity in the coming climate catastrophe. But there's a hell of a lot of work to do, and the solutions are societal, not individual. So get down to the pub or the coffee shop with a few good friends and work out what you're going to do together to make a difference. Good luck. We're all going to need it.
And you can say that again, Bruce. Bruce Edgerton is a policy advisor with the ACT government and a past aficionado of pig farming. Next week, Occam's Razor turns 30. We started in September 1984 with two inflammatory talks by Peter Farrell of ResMed fame. He castigated bureaucrats like Bruce quite pitilessly, as well as universities and the CSIRO. But we shall celebrate appropriately with Professor Hugh Taylor from the University of Melbourne with news on helping the poor to see again. I'm Robin Williams.